Welcome, everyone. This is the sixth and final office hours session for Basics of Economics, the online Mises Academy class, Action and Exchange. And we will turn it over to the people who are currently logged in. So go ahead and fire away, guys. I think some of you are even logged into the previous session, so if you want to repeat something from there that I didn't touch on, feel free to do that too. Okay. Kim Alexander says, from an economics understanding, why was the chart of Alice and Billy so important? Okay, so Kim is referring to the chart in the Lessons for the Young Economist with the Halloween candy example. What I was trying to do there, Kim, was really get you to see from the ground up how you could explain the emergence of an equilibrium price. And because that's actually, because usually what happens is in economics intro courses, the way you end up explaining market prices is just by drawing supply and demand curves. And then where the curves intersect, that's the market price and the equilibrium quantity. There you go. And I think, so first of all, in some courses, they don't even really talk about where those curves come from and what they represent. And also, even if they do, they're denominated in money. So like in the United States, it would be in dollars. And so they start from the get-go saying, well, the demand for a product is how many units a person would be willing to buy at various possible prices, where the prices are measured in dollars. And then that's how they do it. So it's not exactly obvious how that translates to the more fundamental point where we say, oh, people have ordinal preference rankings and that's what we exhibit in action. And so, in other words, it's not obvious, wait a minute, if that's what the preferences really are, or at least that's the kind of preference we can say exists if we're just relying on action the way that somebody like Mises would want us to do, then what does it mean to explain market prices by just, it seems like we're doing it from a totally different perspective. If we just say, how many units would you be willing to buy at various prices? That kind of doesn't, where is that coming from? Like, how do you know what a dollar is? Okay, so what I was doing, that Halloween candy example, is to show that actually with economic theory, you tend to start from the more primitive, these are the ways I rank various possible units of goods. And then just from that information alone, we can talk about, then put people in interacting with each other, making potential having potential trades. And you can talk about what would an equilibrium in this environment look like, without there being money at all, and without just assuming we know from scratch how many Milky Ways each kid would want at various possible prices. All right, so because that's not what your primitive thing is. It's not like you're born and come out of the womb knowing how many dollars you'd be willing to spend on various things. That's clearly not what's going on. Like, your evaluation of what a dollar is a pretty sophisticated thing. And it has to do with you knowing what a dollar can buy in the marketplace. So that clearly can't be the starting point of the analysis to say, where do prices come from? Especially in an environment with no money. So Austrian theory, as developed by Menger and Babovic in particular, they can explain prices from scratch in a direct exchange situation. And so that's what I was trying to capture in that Halloween candy example. So the pedagogical function of it was to show you look at, you know, it's not just that we're paying lip service to having ordinal preference route ranking, and then when we go to do the economics, we start with something else. I was trying to show you that we really can build up everything from what we said are the essential building blocks. So that's the reason for doing that. And also, I think it is important for you to realize that you can have exchange ratios without there being money. And so that's partly why I went through that so carefully. Okay. Hey, let me just check my email to make sure nobody's stranded. Since I had another, I'm doing the Obamacare class. There's a slight overlap with your guys' class that I didn't think it through carefully. But another session that somebody coming in to log into this might be confused and try to log into the other one. So I'm just checking my email and make sure nobody's getting stranded. Okay, Malcolm says, you wrote, many people would agree that psychiatry was doing all right until Sigmund Freud. Question, could you comment on the change that Freud had on psychiatry and what it was like before him? probably not very knowledgeably, Malcolm. I mean, here I'm not relying on any deep knowledge of the history of psychiatry. I just mean more of the stereotypical, that Freud made things very sexual. And that, you know, a lot of stuff about, so I mean, I'm exaggerating a bit, and one could be a psychiatrist in the Freudian tradition without necessarily, you know, getting into really crazy stuff. But, you know, the stereotype associated with him that when you want to diagnose somebody and say, oh, well, it's because you have issues with, you know, repressed issues with your mother or your father or whatever. And so what I'm saying is I am confident in claiming a lot of people would agree that going down the path of Freudian psychology was a cul-de-sac. And maybe he had some important insights, but that it was important to kind of pull back from that and regroup. And so I was, remember the context of that discussion was to say, why is it that in certain sciences, it seems like it's always getting better and better? Like that with physics and chemistry and the real hard natural sciences, it doesn't seem like there's something analogous to Freudian psychiatry it might even be considered psychology too. I think that it could cut both ways there. And then in economics, of course, a lot of current Austrians would say economic science was derailed during the Keynesian Revolution. And so my point in the text there was to say, something seems odd here. How is it that economics and psychiatry can apparently go off on a tangent for 20 and 30 years, whereas you don't really hear something like that in physics so much. It's not like they would normally say something like, oh yeah, we dabbled in quantum physics for 30 years or so, but now we realize that was a big waste of time. I mean, they might change their understanding of something, or maybe a better example is Newtonian mechanics. So physicists no longer believe in Newtonian mechanics, but they still agree Newtonian mechanics was an advance over what physicists were doing before Newton came along. Okay, so it's not that you're, I mean, there's always in a sense in which you realize what you were doing before was wrong, but it seems like in the really hard natural sciences, it's not like you could lose 30 years. Whereas in the social sciences, it does seem like that's possible and in fact has happened, at least according to several people in the respective fields. Okay, Malcolm says, you had a question at the end of the chapter, would you classify intelligent design theory as a natural or a social science? I would say it as a social science. What is the answer? There was no one particular answer I wanted there, Malcolm. It was more of a, you know, get the student to think about it. So you could go either way with it. So for people who don't know, intelligent design theory is the idea or the claim that, well, it's theory, saying that if you look in nature at the biological organisms that are on planet Earth, because of certain patterns in them, and there's lots of different types of evidence a theorist in this school of thought would use to make the case, but they're going to say there is evidence here that there was an intelligence behind the design of the various organisms we see on Earth, and that to say this is merely the result of random mutations that acted upon by natural selection over billions of years, that is not an adequate explanation to explain what we see here. Okay, so right now, I don't want to get into it right now in terms of whether that's a good or a bad hypothesis, but that's what the hypothesis is. And so what I was asking in that question is, would such a theory fall into the natural or social sciences? And you could kind of go either way with it. So biology is a natural science. And so since intelligent design theory is talking about biology, look, also, too, I mean, you could make it broader. Like some people, there's what's known as a fine-tuning argument for the evidence of the existence of a person who designed the universe to support life. Because there's a lot of coincidences that, like the charge on an electron and other natural constants and things like that, even some atheist physicists and cosmologists will say something like, you know, it's almost as if these fundamental constants were chosen in order to make life possible as we know it, something like that. Okay, and so, but clearly the raw material that intelligent design theory uses is what traditionally falls under the natural sciences of biology and chemistry and possibly cosmology, if you wanted to get in that level of analysis. And so in that respect, you think they're natural sciences. But since what they're saying is that we're not trying to explain these things through blind mechanical forces, but instead we're looking for an intelligence behind it, then it seems like it's a social science. Because that's kind of the hallmark of social sciences, is that you perceive action in the way that Mises used the term. And so I was trying to make it just connect to something that was topical by saying, notice that's what the intelligent design people are doing. They're looking at nature and saying, I see evidence of action here. It looked like there is a being trying to achieve ends in what I see here, that I'm not going to interpret this merely as the blind unfolding of mechanical operations with no mind at work. Okay, so that's why I put that question there. I didn't have any preferred answer, and there's a sense in which we go either way. I guess if I had to say, I guess you're right. I guess I would say it's social science because of what I just said, but it's an interesting hybrid where it's a social science that primarily deals with things that traditionally fall under the natural sciences in terms of the evidence or the objects under study. Okay. And incidentally, let me just say one last thing on that. It's true that it is typically the people who advance intelligent design theory are religious, and they're doing it to try to show, hey, there's empirical objective scientific evidence for the God that I happen to believe in religion. All right, so that certainly, you know, I don't want to be coy and deny that. But I just would caution some people in their zeal to attack the legitimacy of intelligent design, I think they overstep and they say, like, this is an unscientific question. Like that's by definition, if you're even entertaining the idea that maybe organisms on Earth have been designed by an intelligence, then you're no longer speaking science. And I think that that's going too far, because for all we know, aliens could have arisen on, you know, some distant solar system through the mechanism that standard Darwinian biology talks about. You know, the lightning bolt could have hit, and amino acids could have blah, 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 and then through natural selection and random mutation, these intelligent aliens evolved over billions of years over their solar system. They build spaceships. They come to Earth that has no life on it, but is, you know, has water and, you know, the right kind of temperature range or whatever for what they want to do. And then they could have engineered and designed and seeded with, you know, S-E-E-D-E-D, like an apple seed, seeded life on Earth. And it's possible, and so that it could be true that what the ID people are saying, hey, you know, the complexity and stuff that we're seeing here, it looks like there's too much information. Like they couldn't have arisen like this from step-by-step random mutation. They could be right. Or rather, you can't say that they're wrong, because to even suggest that is unscientific. Because again, it doesn't necessarily mean the intelligence has to be some supernatural being associated with monotheistic religions. Okay, so anyway, that's just my little soapbox there. Like, I like to referee these disputes, and in the intelligence, I read a lot a few years ago about the intelligence design movement. It seemed like the people representing the orthodox, you know, Darwinian position were a lot of times overstepping and saying, you know, the very idea that you're going to try to attribute intelligence to this shows you're not being scientific. And so I'm saying, well, if you want to take that route, then you better hope that aliens didn't happen to have invented life here on Earth, because if they did, you're just saying now it's impossible for science to ever know that. In principle, you've closed off that route of inquiry. Okay. I mean, let me just say one more thing in case it sounds like I'm grasping at straws. I mean, suppose we found a crashed alien ship and they had a recording and showed us tape of them 2 billion years ago seeding life on Earth. I mean, at that point, wouldn't it possibly be, you know, an open scientific question at that point? Did life really emerge here just through spontaneous, mindless operations, or was there an intelligence, you know, or would have somehow somebody like took the sequencing of DNA in humans and ran it through some kind of like code breaking algorithm, and messages from the aliens started popping out, like giving us the coordinates of their home planet and instructions on how to build a ship that goes faster than light to reach their home planet, and, you know, to say, we embedded these instructions here because we knew, if, you know, the time when you were able to uncode these messages, you'd be ready to come visit us, or, you know, something like that. And again, I'm just being goofy here, but I'm saying, surely, in principle, there's evidence in the natural world that might lead you to suspect that life on Earth came from somewhere else and wasn't intelligently designed. And so to ask that question can't be unscientific in principle, because for all we know, that is what happened. It's surely you would use science to figure out whether that's a plausible hypothesis or not. So maybe you think it's a ridiculous hypothesis, and the evidence overwhelmingly comes down in favor of, no, life didn't appear on Earth. Fair enough. But I'm just saying, an alternate hypothesis is not per se unscientific. Okay. Malcolm says, one possible answer is that the social sciences have justified some pretty awful things, such as electroshock therapy for people incarcerated against will, and the government-sponsored slaughter of millions of pigs during the Great Depression while Americans starved. Question, please tell us about the pigs being slaughtered in the government program. Oh, okay. For a second there, Malcolm, I was like, yeah, this guy's making a lot of sense. And I realized you were quoting from my book. Okay, yeah, so during the Great Deal, the New Deal, the Great Depression and the New Deal. That's what happened there. I mixed those two together. What they wanted to do, and this started under Herbert Hoover, but really reached the pinnacle under FDR. They wanted to, part of the problem was, so prices were falling, and farmers in particular were getting hit hard. That in general, there was price deflation, but the farmers, a lot of them had mortgages on their property, so they owed fixed dollar amounts to the bank, you know, because they had taken out loans either to buy the property or taken out loans to get seed or whatever they do each harvest cycle with their property as sort of the collateral, and then thinking, oh yeah, we're going to plant, grow the crops, and then sell them and get the money, and then we're going to pay the bank, and it's going to be great. Well, if prices collapse, then that doesn't work anymore, because it's not like your mortgage payment goes down. That's a fixed dollar amount, right? So a lot of farmers were in serious trouble. Traditionally, the United States government is very friendly towards farmers and wants to do things to help them economically. And so both Hoover, but then especially FDR, wanted to come up with a way to help the farmers. And so one of the things they did is they were paying farmers to not grow food, to not plant stuff. They were paying them to cut back on production. All right, because the idea was that if the farmers all cut back, you know, withdrew supply, the prices would go up. So that would work, you know, for the next harvest cycle, right, to get them to plant less and to like let certain, you know, land just lie fallow and not cultivate for that season. But the issue is when they first came on the scene, there already was a glut of output. You know, there are too many crops and stuff. And so what the federal government did was actually ordered farmers to slaughter pigs and to burn crops and to, you know, so because the point was to reduce supply. So yeah, it made more sense going forward to just not create the stuff in the first place. But the problem was, given that they already had produced too much in the past, what do we do right now? And they're saying, well, instead of trying to sell all this stuff and then we'll depress the price, just destroy some of it, and that'll raise the price. So it's not something that any individual would ever have done. If you're, you know, a farmer and you have a bunch of oranges, and you're thinking, oh man, if only we all could have collectively reduce the stock of oranges by 10%, we'd all actually make more money, you know, because prices would be higher. Even though we're selling fewer units, maybe the price rises so much we make more money. Even if that's true, it doesn't make sense for any individual farmer to destroy his crop, to, you know, destroy his oranges, because then the other people benefit and he's the one who takes the loss, right? So you need the government to have like a cartel and have the government enforce this on everybody, and then that makes the farmers richer. So this, you may remember, this was a famous scene in the novel The Grapes of Wrath by Steinbeck. And Steinbeck thought he was critiquing capitalism, because Steinbeck observed that people are starving. We're in the midst of the Great Depression, and he sees, you know, large agricultural operations dousing oranges with gasoline and then like putting them on the side of the road and letting them rot, but they douse them with gasoline to make sure that no one eats them, because they're afraid if they just, you know, in other words, they're not going to sell them because they want to keep them off the market, and so they're just going to get rid of them. But if they just like threw it in the dumpster or whatever at the side of the road, hungry people would just go up and steal it or just take it, whatever, whether you want to call it stealing or not. And so the companies didn't want that to happen, so they doused it with gasoline to make sure nobody can, you know, that it's no longer edible. And the same thing too, when he documents that, you know, seeing rivers of blood from all these baby pigs being slaughtered while people are starving. And so Steinbeck saw that and thought, That is the logic of pure laissez-faire capitalism, that while people are starving down the street, you've got these rich agricultural companies literally destroying food in order to fatten their profits. And so, you know, for him, that's clearly a failure of capitalism. So the irony there is, no, that was not capitalism in operation. That would not have happened under capitalism, because it doesn't make sense for any individual producer to destroy his property. That only happened because the government came in and organized all that. So if you'll forgive the shameless self-promotion, I have a book, The Politically Incorrect Guide to the Great Depression and the New Deal, where I go over that and a lot of other interesting stuff, too, that you might be interested in. Okay, Malcolm's doing awesome. He's got all kinds of good questions here. Malcolm says, your book, Lessons for the Young Economist, is very well written, at least chapters 1 through 6. Haven't read the rest yet. Okay, thanks. I thought you were going to say it. Chapter 7, it took a nosedive. In your experience of teaching this material, at what age are kids able to comprehend your book? What materials would you recommend for a younger audience? Do you have any teaching tips or teaching at the comprehension level of Lessons for the Young Economist? Okay. First of all, Malcolm, do you know that there's a teacher's manual? I mean, make sure you're aware of that, that there is a teacher's manual for the Lessons for the Young Economist that accompanies the textbook that you're using for this course. And so the PDF of the teacher's manual is also available. So if you are available, if you Google Lessons for the Young Economist teacher's manual PDF, you should get it. You can see what I'm talking about. I mean, there's a hard copy too. So that gives, you know, sample quizzes and stuff like that. Just to warn you, we didn't want the answers floating around the internet. And so if you did, you know, if you were going to homeschool somebody or whatever, you probably do want to buy the actual physical version of the teacher's manual, because that has the answers and stuff. Whereas the online PDF doesn't have the answers. It just has what the quizzes are. I think I'm saying that right. I mean, I know for sure it doesn't have the answers. I can't remember if it shows all the quizzes or if we even suppressed some of those so that a homeschooling kid wouldn't know, you know, what his final exam was going to be ahead of time. But I can't remember exactly what we put in and what we kept out. But there's all kinds of stuff in there, Malcolm, about, like, if you're going to go on a road trip, what kind of game could you play in the car to illustrate some of these ideas? So there's all kinds of stuff in there that sounds like what you're asking me. As far as age, you know, I don't think it's really a function of age. I think it's a function of the maturity of the student. That I imagine there are kids in sixth grade that could understand this stuff. And then there are some young adults who are in their 20s that wouldn't understand it. So I wrote the book having in mind an audience from like 7th grade up through 10th grade. That's kind of the age I had in mind when I wrote it. And that's how I picked the language and the example, stuff like that. And I was trying to gear it towards that age group. In terms of the spectrum, what I pictured is a kid would read this first, Lessons for the Young Economist, and then the next book would be Henry Hazlitt's Economics in One Lesson. Because before, I used to recommend Hazlitt's book as the starter book for somebody who was interested in free market economic thought, even before anything by Rothbard, when Rothbard's an extremely clear writer. I thought Hazlitt's book was the thing to do. But then I reread it at some point a few years ago, I think because there was like an anniversary, it was reissuing it or something. And I reread it, and it was, I mean, yeah, it was great, but I realized, oh my gosh, this is kind of hard. And not that it was difficult material, but that he was writing it for an adult. And that, you know, so an adult who has a job, who has a house and understands taxes, has the book is great for that kind of person. But I realized a young student, or even like a junior high student, just wouldn't have had the life experience and wouldn't really care about some of the stuff that Hazlitt was talking about enough to really make the kid blow through that book necessarily. And so because of that, that's partly what when we were conceiving the idea of, okay, should we write something that's a little bit before that? I mean, that's partly what made me choose or make the decisions I did for Left of the Economist. Is in my mind, I was thinking what role this is going to fill, is this is going to be what you give to a student before economics in one lesson. But then you say, okay, well, what if you got a kid who's like, you know, 8 years old or something? Like, I have a son who just turned 9, and I certainly have not tried to get him to read Lessons for the Economist. I'm not a sadist. There are things like, what's her name? I'm reviewing her name. Stephanie Herman, I think. I know her first name is Stephanie. Unfortunately, I'm blanking on her last name. She has a book that's intended for a slightly younger audience, but I haven't fully gotten through that yet, so I can't say whether I think it's good or not. There's a lot of stories, and that's the kind of thing that I like, is like children's stories or fables that are supposed to sort of give a free market lesson. There's Richard Mayberry's Whatever Happened to Penny Candy. A lot of people have said that's a very good introduction. So with those things, a lot of those things, unfortunately, I have not personally reviewed them, so I can't say. I'm just saying I know there is ostensibly a bunch of stuff available that would be suitable for even younger kids interested in this stuff. Okay. Malcolm says, did one version of your book, Lessons for Young Economists, have one more chapter than another version? In a previous class, I made a note to myself about this, and I'm having trouble deciphering it. It was with regard to chapter 20. What is chapter 20, Malcolm? I don't have it in front of me. I don't remember off the top of my head. Okay, and then Malcolm says, what book would you recommend after economics in one lesson? It depends what the person wants. Here, let me find, because on my blog, one time I wrote up a general reading list. And so let me just give you that right now. Bob Murphy, free advice, reading list. Yeah. Okay, so if people are just hearing the audio of this and you're curious, it's the title of my blog post is Reading List in Austrian Economics and Libertarianism. So if you Google what I just did right now in a word, if you go to Google and say Bob Murphy Free Advice Reading List, because the name of my blog is Free Advice, that should work. Okay, so let me give it to you here. So Malcolm, you may not be shocked to hear that the one I recommend after Economics in One Lesson is my own book, The Politically Incorrect Guide to Capitalism. If what you're after is a general introduction to free market thought, and I hope that doesn't, how can I put it? People might think it's funny when authors recommend their own books, but it's not pure narcissism. It's because the reason they wrote the book is they thought there was a gap. And so when I wrote The Politically Incorrect Guide to Capitalism, I was actually thinking, okay, if you just got to give a book to somebody who has a basic grounding in, you know, who's already a fan of the market, but just needs to have it spelled out on a whole host of issues, but not get really bogged down in the heavy-duty theory, just have like a leg sprinkling to give an idea of, hey, look at how freedom and free markets can address all these different issues, then that's what I was giving them in that book. So since you're asking me what's after Economics for One Lesson, that's why I would say that particular book. Okay, Malcolm, and then I'm going to hit your question, Kit. Malcolm comes back and says, the economics of drug prohibition was chapter 20. No, Malcolm, I'm not sure what you're talking about. I don't, as far as I can remember, we didn't have a bonus chapter, or there's to my knowledge, there are not two versions of the book floating around. So I don't, I can't even imagine what you're referring to, unfortunately. Okay, so Kim Alexander says, sociologist Max Weber discusses social action in detail and provided a specific typology of social action. And then she's got in parentheses, value, action, means, end, action, etc. Do you know if Mises developed his theory of social action using Weber? Unfortunately, Kim, this is a little bit outside my pay grade. Let me see if I can just Google something. I know a lot of people have written scholarly papers comparing Mises and Weber, but I don't know. Yeah, I mean, I'm seeing here there's an article. Ludwig Lachmann, who is an Austrian economist, has a book here called The Legacy of Max Weber. So here, let me, there's the URL, Kim, if you're curious. And in the introduction to it, the person who's writing, you know, from the Mises Institute, who's writing, you know, the introduction to this book, or the blurb for it, I don't know if it's inside the book, cover itself, is saying that, yeah, Mises' methodological view were influenced by him. So, which, that would have been my guess, but I didn't want to go ahead and say that because that's not something I'm great at. Whereas somebody like David Gordon, you know, give you an impromptu lecture on this issue, I didn't want to say something and not really be sure what I was talking about. Kim asks, is Gordon a sociologist? No, yes and no. I mean, David Gordon knows everything, and I'm only half kidding. He's, I think his actual degree is, it's in some odd-sounding title, like history of thought or something like that, like not a specific discipline, but he's got a photographic memory, but I mean, it's, he really knows a lot of that stuff, and he can tell you what this person thought, what that person thought, and what this person wrote about that person, and that. So, I'm sure he could explain to you in much better detail than I could exactly what Mises used from Weber and what he didn't. Malcolm says, speaking of sociology, who would be the sociologist today that you would recommend reading who operate within an Austrian, Misesian, and Rothbardian framework? Again, I don't know the field enough, Malcolm. And maybe Kim, is that what you are? Are you a professor in sociology? I mean, do you have any thoughts on that? Yeah. For people who are just listening to the audio, she said she would recommend. Now, Kim, is it Weber? Like, do I say it Weber with a W? Or do I say Weber, like as if it were a V, even though it's written with a W? Or Weber. Max Weber. Okay. Great. So, like Darth Vader, Max Weber. Okay. Okay, so that's who, by the, for people who are hearing the audio of this, or if you can't see the chat box, that's who she recommended. But he's no longer lecturing, is my understanding. Okay, Malcolm says, I'm not skipping your guys' questions, right? Okay, Malcolm asks, a company has an inventory of 10 widgets on a shelf that customers serve themselves. I was just skimming this to make sure, Malcolm. I was wondering if you were quoting the book or this is just something you're making up here. Okay. So this is kind of long, so people who are listening, that should brace yourselves to listen to the full scenario. A company has an inventory of 10 widgets on a shelf that customers serve themselves during a sales period, which they sell for $2 each, while their total cost of stocking and selling them is $1 each. At the end of the sales period, the company sells 6 widgets. What are the opportunity costs for the remaining 4 widgets? My coworkers said that the opportunity costs are $4, as each one of the remaining 4 widgets could have been sold. I said the opportunity costs were the interest rate that could have been earned on the cost of the remaining 4 widgets as they were unused stock. In practice, to be sure that one couldn't sell all the widgets in stock, one widget would have to be left on the shelf unsold, demonstrating there was not a demand for that widget, and then the monies used on the remaining widgets could have been invested. My point is that opportunity costs can't be calculated from what an item normally sells for. It is calculated on the unsold portion and how best, and then it trails off. He was typing more. And how best that unsold portion could have been used in the meantime. In this case, investing it and getting interest on the unsold portion of capital. Okay, this stuff always gets really tricky when you're working with a specific example and you're saying what's the cost of this. And so I'm glad that you're phrasing it as the opportunity cost and you're looking beyond just the monetary expense. Excuse me. So that I think the best way, Malcolm, that you're always going to be okay with these sorts of things, the approach you want to take is to be crystal clear on what your action set was. What particular action are you, because remember, there's not a cost of the physical thing. It's not that the widget cost anything. Okay, just like the widget can't have sinned or can't have committed a crime. The widget doesn't cost anything. What carries a cost, what is costly, is your choice. And so if what you guys are saying is, okay, we had 10 widgets on the shelf and we only sold 6 of them, so what was the cost initially of our putting those 4 additional widgets on the shelf? I want to say compared to what? What was the next best thing you would have done at that point? And so you want to look at what the alternate possibility would have been. And so you got to just be, I mean, so it's possible that your coworker's answer is correct if the way they're framing things, they're thinking of a different decision from what you're thinking of. Okay, so even though it sounds like you may think that what I say, you're going to be able to interpret it and say, yeah, that's exactly what I was talking about, I'm right. Just be careful and charitable. You don't necessarily want to go back to and say you're working. No, you guys are a bunch of idiots, and I got this PhD economist telling me you're a bunch of idiots. That's not necessarily what I'm saying. It's possible they're framing the decision and the possible choices differently from how you're framing it. Because the other thing too is, you didn't give me enough information here. If the widgets are unsold after that time, what are we going to do with them? I need to know what are you, given that you decided to put those 4 widgets on the shelf that didn't sell during the period, in order to evaluate the full ramifications of that choice, I need to know what are you going to do with them at the end. Are you going to like cut the price and sell them for something else? Are you going to throw them out? Are you going to sell them for scrap? You get what I'm saying? Like, so it's hard to know what the different, because otherwise what you're going to end up doing, like if you want to say, hey, instead of, let's see, what they cost $1 each, because you're going to think, presumably you're going to say, No, instead of spending the $4 and putting them on the shelf and they just sit there and do nothing for us, we could have refrained from doing that, taken the $4 and invested it. And so then at the end of this period, we would have had $4 plus some interest. And instead of that, instead of having the $4 plus interest, we have the four widgets. And so what I'm saying, Malcolm, is it's not obvious how do you compare those two things, because one is denominated in widgets and one's denominated in dollars. And so to really get a sense, you'd want to know, like, so if you had told me, oh, shoot, since we were sitting there with these four widgets on our shelf, we're just going to cut the price and sell them for a nickel a piece, well, then I'd be able to, you know, compare the two situations, because then at a given point in time, on both timelines, I would be able to say at this point, I have $4.80 because of the interest, and over here I only have 20 cents because I had to sell the four widgets for a nickel a piece. And so I can clearly see it's 20 cents compared to $4.80. Clearly, the other way would have been better. But if I just end up with, I'm stuck with four widgets over, you know, because part of what's going on here, you know, it sounded like your example. If it's a store where you want to have items on the shelves for customers, you might not want it to go down to zero, and not even because you're going to miss out on the sale, but just because it might not look good, right? If you go to a grocery store, and the shelves, a lot of times look bare, or it looks like, you know, there's cans that are way in the back, or you can see that they only have the front row filled with cans, and behind it just all empty space. That just doesn't look very nice. And so there's that sort of, you know, sort of, it's kind of intangible, but also it means more people are going to come to your store and keep it well stocked. So I'm just saying it gets really complicated when you try to do this thing in practice, because technically you want to say, what's the value to you? What's the benefit of ending up with those four widgets on the shelf? And it's not, you know, so I realize that this is getting more open-ended than you probably wanted. But I'm just pointing out, to really do it properly and to close the loop and be able to say definitively, you want to be able to end the period of analysis and say, we're not considering anything else, and that you want to be able to compare apples to apples. And so if you end up with one decision leaves you with widgets, and it's not really clear what the widget does for you, because you want to stop the analysis and not worry about the next period, and the other decision leaves you with dollars, well, it's not obvious how to compare those things. But actually, Malcolm, I think you're right that if what you're saying is, well, no, I'm not worried about what the benefits were, I just want to know what the cost was, then yeah, the cost of you putting those extra four on the shelf, if we assume the next best thing, you know, so had we not done that, we just would have lent the money out at interest, then the cost would be even there, now I'm getting a little lost myself, because it depends at the moment of the decision, the cost is the $4. You see what I'm saying? If you want to reckon what is the cost at the end of the period, then it's the four plus the interest. So even there, you got to be real careful about how you phrase it. it's an interesting question, because normally we want to say the cost, you incur the cost at the moment of the choice. So it's a bit weird to say, right now, what is the cost of a decision I made 2 days ago? That normally that kind of doesn't make sense. So it's I totally get what you're saying, and I'm sure you're thinking about it more properly than your coworkers are. I'm just warning you that this stuff is really tricky. Just to give you another example of how, and on the one hand, it's almost absurd. It almost makes me worry that maybe economics isn't really a very rigorous discipline when stuff like this happens. But I'm just going to be honest with you guys. We got into an argument or a discussion. Argument's a strong word. When I was at NYU, I was a grad student, and it was a colloquium, which, you know, means people present papers and stuff. And we got into this issue about, at a fast food restaurant, Mario Rizzo was the one who was running it. We got into a a discussion about it. Rizzo wasn't the one who posed this question. It was another guy who frequently would attend the colloquium. He taught at a nearby school. And the issue was, in standard mainstream price theory, the equilibrium outcome, well, the efficient outcome, if you have a perfectly competitive market, is that price is set to marginal cost. And so that there's issues about what, you know, whether that can happen if you don't have perfect competition and stuff. But this guy was pointing out, he was saying, wait a minute, in a fast food restaurant, when the burgers are already, you know, like at McDonald's or something, you know how they make the stuff ahead of time so that when you walk in and you say, give me two cheeseburgers, depending on the time of day or whatever, they're not making the cheeseburgers when you order. The cheeseburgers are already sitting there under the lamp, and they just, you know, throw it on the tray and there you go, especially if you go busy at lunch or something. So his point was, if the hamburger has already been made and it's just sitting there, well, isn't the marginal cost of then giving it to the customer basically zero? Because what else are you going to do with it? They're just going to throw it out at that point, you know, because the costs expended up to that point making it at that moment are sunk. And so at the moment when you've got the hamburgers sitting there already wrapped under the heat lamp, or you could say the fries, and if the hamburger seems too contrived, and clearly they put the fries in the grease or whatever and get those things made and they dump them under the heat lamp and they're sitting there. So when you walk in and order a large fry at McDonald's, technically those fries sitting there, what else would McDonald's do with them if they didn't give them to you? They might give them to their employees for free, but after a while they're going to get sick of them. So really they're going to throw them out. And so then the question is, okay, so what's the marginal cost to McDonald's of giving you that thing of large fries? I mean, they could say it's the container, because they don't need to throw the container out. But strictly speaking, the fries are free, and the marginal cost is free. So if they're supposed to charge marginal cost to break for there to be efficiency, does that mean then that McDonald's should be giving away food for free? And so we argued about that for a while, and I still don't like the way we concluded it. I don't think they analyzed it right. So again, it matters as to what's the relevant time frame and what decision are you talking about? Because clearly part of what's going on in that odd example is to just focus narrowly and say the moment at which the fries have already been made and they're sitting there. And incidentally, that's also in reality, like I've gone to a Dunkin' Donuts before just to get coffee. Like if I had a late night, you know, I was going to stay up and do an all nighter, and if I had a deadline or something, I was going to stay up till 6 a.m. writing this paper. And so I've gone to Dunkin' Donuts right before they close and gone in just to get a coffee. And then the person, you know, will say, hey, do you want any of these donuts? Because I'm throwing them out. So he'll just give me the donuts. So it's actually kind of funny that actually what that guy was talking about came true, that they were charging me as the marginal cost of zero, and they're about to throw the stuff out. So anyway, it is, and so that kind of does resurrect the neoclassical theory, so the mainstream theory that, yeah, it would be inefficient if McDonald's is throwing food out when they could have announced to the world, we'll sell it to you for 5 cents because we're about to throw it out, and then people would have lined up and said, yeah, I'll take that. But, you know, then that leads to issues of, well, if people knew McDonald's was going to do that, they wouldn't buy it at the normal price 20 minutes before closing. They would wait 20 minutes till McDonald's was then going to have to throw it out, and then they want it for 5 cents. So you see how the point is, we're sitting there, a bunch of economists, or, you know, I didn't quite have my PhD, and I was still a grad student, but sitting there arguing about something that a regular business person would laugh at us and say, what are you talking about, you idiots? But yet, you know, just for us to be able to explain the world in terms of our formal models, it wasn't obvious exactly how to fit it into the framework. Okay. Let's see, we got 5 minutes left here. But one last thing on all that stuff. I mean, the market, these issues that the economists using their formal models come up with, they're legitimate things. It's just, unfortunately, so often, since they can't see how the market would deal with it because the way they think the market's supposed to work can't work in this quirky setting. And so they just go, oh, well, that's why you need the government. Or that's why the market. But then the market comes up with innovative ways to deal with it. So, for example, there's this issue of what if you have, you know, retail outlets where there's large fixed costs but then very low marginal costs. You know, so it you have to spend a lot of money up front building the warehouse and getting all the, you know, the transportation infrastructure. But then once you got the stuff coming in, whether you sell the customer one roll of toilet paper or 12 rolls of toilet paper, you know, on the margin, giving them an extra roll of toilet paper is pretty cheap. But yet, if a standard grocery store is going to be selling stuff, they can't, you know, they can't charge you $5 for the first roll and then charge you a nickel for the subsequent roll. That just wouldn't work. And so the way in practice that gets solved is you have things like Sam's Club and BJ's Club, or I forget what the term that is, but BJ Warehouse or whatever that's called. You know, those membership clubs where you pay a membership fee to be a member, and then that gives you access to being able to buy the stuff at what seem to be pretty low prices per unit compared to if you shopped at a regular grocery store. And so that's the vision of was it Sam Walton set that up and whatever. They realized what the economists were pointing out, but instead of just saying, well, the market failed, they were like, well, no, what can we do to come up with a clever pricing strategy to deal with this, that we have to be able to cover our fixed costs, but then we want to be able to offer to our customers the stuff, you know, at a price reflecting the fact that to us, the marginal cost, you know, once we have the warehouse up and running, to bring in, you know, to have a more volume flowing through, that doesn't cost us that much more. So, okay. Two more questions here, and we're going to run out of time. Malcolm says, you use the term equilibrium position. Question, would mainstream economists use the term equilibrium versus equilibrium position? If so, please explain why. Also, you say disequilibrium versus disequilibrium position. Malcolm, I would possibly need to see in context where in the book I use the word equilibrium as opposed to equilibrium position, but unfortunately, I think you're reading too much into it. I don't think that I had some real esoteric point that I was making, that's what shows Austrians are more nuanced than mainstream economists on that particular issue. I mean, it's possible. Like to say like a price is not a position. And so if I was using the word equilibrium at one point to refer to the prices, I might not have used the word position because that would have sounded funny. But I think what I was just trying to, I might have been saying equilibrium position. It might have been a little bit redundant just because if a younger reader wasn't sure what the word equilibrium meant, if I used it as a noun, then they might have been lost, whereas I was kind of using it like an adjective, say equilibrium position, to mean, like, to make sure they realize what an equilibrium is. It means you're stable, you're not moving around. That's what economists mean by equilibrium. The forces are balanced out, so there's no reason for you to move away from the equilibrium. And so for me to stress that, I said the equilibrium position to get the younger reader to realize we're talking about a stable resting point. Okay, last question. Malcolm asks, how do you differ from Walter Block in his position of voluntary slavery? If you were to take a guess, what percent in the anarcho-capitalist camp would agree with his position on this issue? Just trying to gauge how popular his position is. Yeah, okay, so one thing, Malcolm had quoted from the book where I wrote, slavery occurs when some individuals have the legal right to own the bodies and the services of other individuals, both for moral and practical reasons. Slavery forms no part of a pure capitalist system. And so Malcolm inferred from that that I must be disagreeing with Walter Block's view that you can't sell yourself into slavery. Unfortunately, I wasn't trying to, in that phrase there, I was just speaking to the young reader with an introduction. I was just trying to make them see that slavery is not a normal part of capitalism, and that, you know, people looking at historical examples of slavery don't think that when we talk in this book about private property, that that's the kind of stuff we're talking about, because it's not. So I actually was not trying to hear say, in theory, would you have the right to be able to sell your body to somebody else? And I'm not sure if you would be able to or not. I haven't really thought that fully through. So for people who don't know, Walter Block really pushes stuff to the extreme in terms of libertarian theory. And one of his controversial positions is he's saying, hey, if I own my body, part of the attributes of ownership means I'm allowed to sell it, right? Like, I wouldn't really be the full owner of my car if I couldn't sell it to somebody, right? If I had a restriction on my ability to dispose of the property. And so by the same token, if we agree that right now I'm the owner of my body, then why couldn't I go up to somebody and say, hey, if you give me $2 million right now, you own my body. And, you know, so I'm effectively selling myself as a slave. So part of the issue, Malcolm, is there, it gets a little bit tricky as to what exactly does that mean? Is it really just, are you selling a bundle of labor services? Because in the extreme, suppose I go up to somebody and I say, okay, yeah, if you give me $2 million, I agree I'll be your slave. So he goes, okay, so he gives me the $2 million and I say, okay, I'm your slave. And he says, okay, slave, give me that $2 million back. And you're like, oh, you see how that works? So it's clearly, for that to work and to make any sense at all, there's got to be a sense in which even though you're technically a slave, you still have the ability to own property and to make decisions independent of what your owner wants you to do. Otherwise, nobody would voluntarily enter into slavery because there'd be no benefit to it. So there's that kind of quirk. I mean, I suppose there's something else where, like, say your family got really deeply into debt to somebody, and you could go up to the guy, to the creditor, and say, hey, he says you could sell yourself into slavery to pay for surgery. Yeah, okay, I guess there could be cases like that where somebody makes a payment first, and you see what happens. Like, you know, your kid needs a really expensive surgery and does it. And then you say, okay, now that I've seen you done that, you can't take it back. I now agree that I'm your lifelong slave and I have to do whatever you say. I don't know. It gets really tricky because I think part of the issue is, and we got to wrap it up here because we're over time. Okay, quickly, when you say what percentage, I never did a remotely unscientific sample, let alone a scientific survey. I'm guessing 75% of libertarian anarcho-capitalists do not think you can have voluntary slavery, and 25% think Walter Block is right. But again, that's a total guess. I really don't know, but if I had to guess, I would say it's close to that ballpark. The issue is Rothbard denied that that's possible. And so Block here is disagreeing with Rothbard because Rothbard was saying you can't alienate your will. And so he was linking the fact that there's something special about owning self that right now, like you can't even constrain what your future self is going to do. And so if you have free will, if you're, you know, free in a certain sense, you can't sell yourself into slavery today because then that means a month from now, you can no longer do what you want to do. Like, you're no longer a free agent. And so there's a sense in which he's saying you can't do that. And so he would go so far as to say you can't even like a labor contract can't really say that, oh, I'm selling you my labor services 2 years. Like, I agree, I'm going to go to this work project and work there for 2 years, and I agree I'm not going to quit, because what if you get there and 6 months into it, you change your mind and you want to quit? Rothbard's saying that's like forced labor. If you're not allowed legally to quit, that it would be construed as theft if you walked off the job. That's crazy. That can't be right. And so he instead, I mean, there's all kinds of market mechanisms to deal with that. Like, he could say, if you sign a contract that you're going to do the job and you quit, maybe no one's going to hire you again. Or maybe, like, if you're a movie star and you agree to do, you know, to be the star in this movie, the producers are going to be really upset if they do the advertising and fly you out on location. Then you get there and 2 days into shooting, you say, you know what, I don't like this script, I quit. And so maybe what they do is they have you put up a big bond, like that you put up $500,000, and part of the contract says, if I, you know, I'm going to do this movie for $3 million, but if I quit for some reason, you know, and not, you know, you list a bunch of caveats, like, you know, not because you get sick or your kid's in the hospital or something like that, but if I quit just because I don't like it, I forfeit this bond and you keep the $500,000. There could be clauses like that, but the point was, Rothbard was saying, strictly speaking, you cannot be legally bound to perform labor at gunpoint the way, if you try to steal someone's TV, the law can use guns to stop you. And it's not like somebody else could own your labor service in the right to force you to do work for them against your will. That just in principle, that can't happen in a voluntary society. Whereas Walter Block was saying, well, yeah, it could in principle, as long as you voluntarily put yourself in that position. So those are the distinct issues. If I had to choose, Malcolm, I would say Rothbard's right, but legally I can't see, because there's so many other ways you could approximate that outcome to get the outcome you want, where you're giving a lot of your labor service to somebody else in exchange for an upfront lump sum payment without technically you being a slave. And so I can't see that would be a legal outcome, but I could be wrong. All right, thanks, guys. Thanks for the course. I hope you liked it. And remember, we'll have the follow-up in January.